I thank you all for being here. My name is Ray, and I'm an alcoholic. My given name is Raymond, and I really never thought much about that name. You know, it was in the late 20s, there was a mystery show hosted by a guy named Gene Raymond, and my mother thought, God, that sounds cool. I'll name him Raymond. As I said, I never thought much about it until Tony Romano came along. And then I learned from Tony Romano that everybody loves Raymond. And the really good news is today, I love Raymond. You know, on any given day, I love Raymond. I want to thank Chris for inviting me to come and speak at the Ventura County Convention, Serenity by the Sea. In my wildest dreams, I never thought, geez, I'd like to come and speak at the Ventura County Convention. And I came up here, I was telling Shelley earlier, that I'm just like this, you know, and I don't know why, I just am, you know. But as soon as I get to rocking and rolling, things will be better, you know. And I want to thank Chris, and I want to thank the Ventura County group council who put this together, who put it together every year and do a really great job. I am happy to be here. I'd love to be with you all. I'm so grateful to be sharing. It's an honor and a privilege to speak at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting ever. I was born, I'll clear up the math pretty quick. I'm 91 years old, and I'm 50 years sober. And I'm almost 36 years retired, and I'm just living the effing dream in my life. I found the job that I'm perfect for, that I can do what I want, when I want, how I want, where I want, and I love it, you know. I take a nap, you know. And I grew up in the 1930s, and there was a tail end of the Depression, not a lot going on then. To this day, I still have a major resentment against my mother, you know, that I was born on an Easter Sunday. And she thought, you know, in her sainted ways, I'll nickname him Bunny. I forgot to set my watch. I may never get off of this podium. You guys have to go home. at any rate, start. And to grow up in the streets of New York wanting to be a tough guy with a nickname like Bunny is not pleasant. My mother had relatives, cousins in Brooklyn, and the husband of the wife was like Ralph Cramden, the bus driver. And we'd come to their house, and he'd say, hippity hop, here comes Bunny. You know, that was so much fun. You know? Some other things that went on that I won't talk about, you know, maybe I will, what the hell. You know, my mother we lived in a fourth floor apartment, and she leaned out the window. I'd be playing with my buddies on the street, she leaned out the window, and she'd say, Bunny, have you been potty yet today? I can tell you, I spent most of my life being full of crap. And I blame it on my mother, you know. So I, Mom, you know, it's the way it is. So to begin with how it used to be, at 17, like I said, we grew up poor, not a lot going on in my life. My mother would, things like give me money to eat out. You know, she divorced my stepfather when I was about 10. And we moved into a tenement on the east side. by the East River at Bellevue Hospital. And I was always insecure and inadequate. And she'd give me money to eat out. And I'd keep the money because, I'd go to eat out. I always knew that people were looking at me, and that was uncomfortable. I didn't want people looking at me. It made me feel even more insecure. So I'd save the money, and after school or after whatever the hell I was doing on hooky, there was a place in mid-street where I lived, a little grocery store owned by Mrs. Olson, and she had candy bars, and I'd fill up on Milky Ways, and she had a custard pie, and I'd get that custard pie and eat all I could and dump the rest, you know. It wasn't a good job for my teeth. Here I am at 91. I'm lucky to have 16 of my own teeth in my head. The rest of it is capped and bridged, you know. But that was, you know, that was my younger life. That was a solid meal for me, was a Baby Ruth in a Milky Way. One of my favorite heroes, Alex Trebek on Jeopardy, his daily routine was going to the studio, Snickers and Pepsis. He's my kind of guy, you know. And at any rate, I went in the Air Force at 17, left home, got tired of everything about town and me, and wanted a new adventure. And I got the new adventure right away down at Wall Street. I was waiting for the rest of the guys that signed up, and we were going on a train going out to San Antonio, Texas, to join the Brown Shoe Army Air Force. That was back in those days, 1948. They had stuck a mop in my hand and said, "Mop the floors." You know, what the hell is this crap? Mop your floors, you know. But that was my life in the Air Force. I was a complete screw up in most all of the time that I spent in the Air Force. Early on, I forget how long basic training was, 7 weeks or something like that. And on the fourth week, they had a granny dance. All the grandmas from San Antonio would come and dance with the Air Force guys and some of the young women as well. And I met Mrs. Wright at that very first dance, and exchanged a phone number and so on and so forth, and we ultimately got married. But to go on with, you know, with my Air Force stuff, I graduated from basic training, and for some strange reason became a drill instructor for a while. And I spent my first Christmas in the Air Force under house arrest, awaiting disciplinary action. Everybody else was gone, and I was by myself in the barracks. It so happened that one of the basic trainees that I was in charge of had some money stolen. I borrowed some money from this guy because I wanted to go to town and get drunk, you know. And all my money was gone from gambling, playing AC/DC and stuff. So I borrowed this guy's money and went off in town, got drunk. And a couple of weeks later, maybe a month or so, this kid had money missing from his footlocker. And they brought in the Office of Special Investigations and all kinds of bullshit. And turned out, he started asking questions. "Has anybody borrowed money from you recently?" And apparently there was some stupid regulation said you couldn't do that. Could not borrow money from basic trainees. So I got disciplinary actioned and sent off to another base, Shepherd Air Force Base in Wichita Falls, Texas. It wasn't the end of the world, but you could see it from there. It was the strangest place. You know, we wake up, it'd be bright and sunny, beautiful day, and a norther would come in from, they called it a norther. Temperature would drop in about 3 or 4 hours from 68 degrees down to 40. You know, it was only place I'd ever been that you could stand knee deep in sand and in water and have sand blowing in your face, you know. Anyways, they decided it would be great to make me a airborne radio mechanic. That was my MOS, my skill. And I learned most of my education was how I learned things was when I pre-flight the airplanes and transmitters and receivers in the airplanes. I used to clean the bird shit off the antenna wires and dust the vacuum tubes. That's how I got my experience and my education in electronics. And to this day, I see myself as the greatest electronics guy that ever lived, you know. And so that was my job for a few years at Shepherd Air Force Base. I was by then married and driving every weekend back and forth to San Antonio to see Mrs. Wright, of course. And after a while, I got tired of that. I was just, you know, a terrible guy to be in a relationship because I didn't have a relationship. I never had a relationship with myself. How the hell could I ever have a relationship with another human being? And as I grew up, something that clicked with me is that to this day, I want the best of everything. I want to be there first. I want the most, and I want the tops. You know, that kind of compensates for my inadequacy and my insecurity. That I get the best of everything, become first, and get the top of the line. You know, and my relationship wasn't it. I mean, Mrs. Wright was a beautiful, wonderful, lovely, lovely lady. And from a nice German family who ran a truck farm in Seguin, Texas, about 20, 30 miles outside of San Antonio. Eventually we divorced, but by August of 1950, I had become a United States Air Force guy. We left the Army in a black shoe, Air Force, and became the United States Air Force with blue uniforms. And I was sent to go to Korea with 50, there was, I guess the 18th Air Force was bombing in Korea from Guam. They ultimately moved to Okinawa. But 54, they gathered in the United States, 54 guys with the same MOS, which was an airborne radio mechanic. So I went to Guam, stayed there for a couple of months because the 18th Air Force had moved to Okinawa and they didn't need us anymore. And all the smart guys on Guam, they said, let's get these guys to do our guard duties from midnight till 8 o'clock in the morning. And I was privileged to guard the water wells at Guam. And got familiar with the coconut crabs and things like that in the middle of the night, walking around with my rifle, you know. But it was a beautiful paradise. I'm glad I didn't stay there, but it was like being in Hawaii, blue ocean, could go scuba diving and stuff. Although I never did any of those kind of things, it was kind of a nice place to be, you know. We shipped out not too long after that to go to Japan. And we went to a repo depot at Tachikawa Air Force Base in Japan. We were 54 guys, 49 guys went to Korea. I was one of the lucky five that got to stay in Japan. And I was so happy. And I was stationed in Nagoya, and ultimately got stationed at a peninsula with about 20 other guys. We ran a transmitter site there at the base, and I, you know, I was well into my alcoholism by then. Drunk most of the time when I was off duty. You know, we got one of those great weeks where we got like 4 days off, 4 days on, and that kind of stuff. And I worked on the midnight to 8 in the morning shift. And so I had all day to drink, you know. And not too long after that, I went to school over there and stuff. I went to electronic school a couple of times down in Tokyo. Went down there with a group of guys one time, and we went clubbing. And I remember we I ran up a big bill, and the guys left. They just run off, and I was almost out the door when they got me, you know. And that was pretty costly, both in whatever stripes I had at the time and my finances. And that was the kind of Air Force stuff that I had. You know, I got a lot of trouble most of the time. And it was all because of alcohol. And I was shipped back to the United States in May of 1952 and got discharged. Because of my unpleasant activities in the time that I was in the Air Force, they decided to give me a general discharge under honorable conditions, where they gave most guys, you know, with the stuff and the stripes and everything, they gave them an honorary discharge, you know. But them bastards, they wanted me to sign up for another 4 years. You know, and I said, no, I don't want that stuff. And they try to convince you're going to be eating out of the Dempsey dumpsters, you know, sign up. I said, no, I don't think so. I don't think I'm going to do that. And so I got discharged with, I was wondering if I'd have spent another 4 years if they'd have let me out with a genuine honorable discharge, you know. Try to pace myself here that I actually can get into staying, you know, learning how to stay sober, you know, when I get out of this stuff. So shortly after I came back, the family thought, you know, we want grandchildren. Gotta have a grandchild. Sounded like a good idea. So we had the grandchild, and it was just like the household that I grew up in, arguing, all kinds of crap going on. Enough of this, you know, and I wanted a divorce. And by that time, I had hooked up with a guy at work from the Marine Corps, and he was my hero. He could drink whiskey out of a chimney glass, you know. And I tied up with this guy, and had a nice brother, a nice mother. Mother used to feed him all the time, and. I decided to get a divorce, and Tommy and I got a place together in town with holes in the floor, looked like a wreck. The place was totally garbaged, and we were mooching off his mother every day for sandwiches and lunch, you know, lunch sandwiches and breakfast. The mother got tired. That crap kicked us out. You know, we're on our own, and it was a real problem. After, I don't know, about 6 months of that, he and I one night with a couple of honeys, I had a girlfriend, he had this gal, and we decided, God, what a great idea. Let's go to Seguin, Texas, wake up a justice of the peace and get married. Can you imagine that we'd do something like that? So we ran off and got married. And I, you know, in my hangover the next day, I said, Raymond, this time I'm going to make it work. He was a smart guy. He went out to Southern California to an aerospace company and got his annulled about 6 months later. I wound up with this lovely honey for about 14 years and made her life the most miserable that a human being could have because of my alcoholism. And we wound up with three children, two girls and a boy. which I wanted absolutely no part of. You know, my whole thing about when am I going to get that next drink? When am I going to get the thing that's going to put salve over my fears? And just because when alcohol first came into my life, it was a perfect blend. You know, I could disappear. I could just blend into the woodwork. And that's what I did in this marriage for about 14 years. I had a great job. I never lost my job because of drinking. At the time, I was working at Kelly Air Force Base. I was now a radar technician working on A-bombs. We'd bring the A-bombs in from storage around the United States and run the local modifications on them. And they had radars in them at that time. It was like the Fat Boy. And they needed them to be able to determine at what altitude set the bomb off, you know, so they get the widest dispersion of death and mayhem, you know. And so I had a great job, and I still had my buddy Tom at that time. No, he'd already gone off to California, I guess. And that went on and on and on. Like I said, you know, everything was her fault. Absolutely everything was her fault. She couldn't take care of the kids. She couldn't break bread. She couldn't make eggs without burning them. She could do anything, you know. And soon after, I got another job and worked for the Air Force at Vandenberg Air Force Base for a while. I worked with a small squadron that hosted the Royal Air Force on their combat training launches. They'd bring their birds in from England, and we'd launch them, get them all prepped up and modified. They'd take them out there, launch the birds, and go home. But one of the beautiful things about hosting was RAF guys, State Department, would turn loose several thousand dollars to party those guys. You know, we'd roast a calf, roast a cow, and all that kind of stuff, and all the drinks you could drink, and have a great time. And that just suited me to a T. Love that alcohol, you know, and the problems that went along with it. Shortly after that, I moved to Sacramento and worked on the ballistic missile early warning system, again, a radar thing. They used height finders. And I also started working on the Titan guidance system. And I got to go to places like in Washington by the dam. I spent some time, 6 months up there, and of course brought the family with me. My thing was totally being with alcohol and leaving them, you know, alone. And my wife at the time always wanted to be back in San Antonio together, San Antonio, Texas, with her family. And I got to go to a 6-month school on the Titan's guidance system, again, at the base that I used to be at, Wichita Falls, Texas. And I dropped my wife off in San Antonio to be with her family. And while I was off at this guidance system school, for 6 months, I was having a heyday, you know. I'd call my ex, my wife once in a while, and so on and so forth. Long story short, when we got ready to go home, I went to pick up my wife in San Antonio. And while I was gone at school, she'd gone to see this psychiatrist in San Antonio. And she talked me into going to see this guy with her. And so we went. We got to the psychiatrist, and he said, why don't you sit in the lobby? I'd like to talk to him alone for a minute. So we're going to talk to this guy. He says, tell me, Raymond, what do you think the problem is in your life? And I gave him the laundry list. You know, you can't do this, you can't do that. She's a pain in the ass. She's, you know, always in my craw and blah, blah, blah. He listened to me, he sat there for a minute, and he says, let me tell you, he says, you're about the sorriest son of a bitch I've seen in a while, you know. And I left his office with my wife. We crossed the street. I felt like I was about that tall, you know, walking across the street, so humble and sick. And, you know, about a month later, Budweiser and Jim Beam, she did it to you again. She did it to you again, that bitch, you know. And so I was off and running again, making her life even more miserable, you know. And she had started working for the state of California on the project to bring water from Northern California down here. And she had this guy at work who said, I was complaining about the burnt toast and rubbery eggs. He'd say, my honey, how sweet you look today. You know, you always have such a bright attitude. Everything's so wonderful. And they went off in the sunset together, you know, and left Raymond all alone. Poor Raymond, you know, poor Raymond. I can really get sauced now. Poor Raymond, you know, gotcha. It's done to me again. I cried and cried and cried. Please come back, please. You know, I went through that whole damn thing. It's easy to say now, but in reality, that's probably the best thing that ever happened to both of us. You know, this guy was 5 years younger than she was, so she got to train him right. You know, he was a geologist, and he got a job with the Forest Service in Idaho, and they moved off. During the time that they were here, however, I had, you know, rights to see the children, and she made it impossibly difficult for me to see the kids. Yeah, go see your dad, but you're going to miss the slumber party, you know, and always roadblocks. And finally, you know, after a while, I just the only thing that was going on was hurting the three children, and I just succumbed to my right not to see them anymore, and allowed them to move to Idaho, where he can continue his project up there. And ultimately, he became as sick a drunk as I was, maybe even worse. They ultimately split. Mary and he had another child who became a local patrolman in a town in Idaho. And the father, you know, the guy, he lived in their house in the basement. And he had one of those liver problems. His liver was so big you could put it in a wheelbarrow. So, you know, it didn't end all that well. And one thing, on and on, and now we can get to the point where I went into my third marriage, and it was a really good one. And this is the time that I wound up getting sober. I had no longer become an electronic technician. I got a job with the Defense Supply Agency in contract administration. And I was a supervisor, a production supervisor. A guy named, back in the 60s, a guy named McNamara, the defense secretary, said, you know, we've got all these problems. You know, we got the Army, Navy, Air Force, Coast Guard, et cetera, et cetera. These guys all have to have different colored underwear. What the hell sense does that make? You know, the Army, Navy, you know, they all use the same vacuum tube, but they call it something different. They want a little different quality for each one. He said, why not buy the top of the line? We'll buy that stuff all at a good price and start saving money. So I went to work for these guys. And as I said, I was a production supervisor. We administered contracts in private industry. And we did things like pre-award surveys Worked on new products, those kinds of things. It's a great job. They sent me to school to how to, you know, get along with people. It was the tail end of the sensitivity movement. And I got to go to the sensitivity school where we sat around in a class about, I recall, it was about eight people, and the guy who I presume was the instructor, and we sat around for maybe 2 or 3 days, nobody saying anything, you know. And what the hell's happening here? Well, you know, what are you doing? You know, and we all got together. I don't know how or why, but we all became the greatest friends in the world, you know, together. I loved that program so much that I wanted to become a guru in the sensitivity movement, you know? So many great things came of that. Number one, I got sober. You know, I was, like it says in the book, self-knowledge is not enough. God, I've read so many books now about sensitivity, how to talk, how to feel about myself, how to feel about you, how to get together and be so gracious and comfortable together, you know, those kinds of things. And I was on a business trip in Santa Barbara. My office was in the San Fernando Valley in the federal building. I went to Santa Barbara to do a special report on something or other. And I was doing so well, I had a couple of drinks. I thought, now I can handle this. I really know I can handle this, you know. I was doing so good. And I called my wife at the time. And I said, I'm gonna go to dinner. I think I'll have a little wine, I'll do this. And she said the magic words. And she says, it sounds to me like you've already had one too many. I said, what? I'll show you, bitch. And I showed her. I had the wine, I had some after-dinner drinks, and I had some more after-dinner drinks. And I was at a little bar down off of State Street, close to Harbor Boulevard. And it was time to leave. It was about midnight. I thought, I better get back to my room and get ready for work in the morning. When I stepped out the door, down the street, I saw black and white. I'm intelligent. Really intelligent. I know those guys are here for me. I know they're here for me. What's the only intelligent thing to do? I go back in the bar, close it up. And I did that. Went back in the bar and closed it up. And I got back in my, I got outside. I said, God, they're not here. I don't know where the hell they went. You know, I got in my car and started up State Street. I probably haven't crossed that yellow line more than a dozen times. I saw these flashing lights in my mirror. Took me out, did the field sobriety test. Took my ass off to the pokey. And on the way to the Santa Barbara County Jail, I remember telling the young police officer, there are people robbing houses tonight. What the hell are you picking on these drunks for? You know? He said the magical words. He says, you know what? I'd rather be doing this than find you dead on the side of the street somewhere, or even worse, that you had killed some poor family with 4 or 5 kids with your drunkenness. I didn't have any more words for him, so they let me off at the jail, I had my business suit on. They took me into the cell. And all the big guys had the beds, so I slept on the floor, you know. And not too long after that, I went to Kaiser. Kaiser started a program for problem drinkers. And I wasn't an alcoholic yet, but I could be a problem drinker, you know. And have I got time left? I hope. And now I could talk about being sober. Anyways, I problem drink, difference between, I love this story about the difference between a problem drinker and an alcoholic. The problem drinker, the wife saying, hey, you know, when you're drinking, you're a pain in the ass. Why don't you just try stopping for a while and be home with us? We love you. You can be happy with the kids, you know, we'll have a good time. The alcoholic, on the other hand, would say, it's time for another wife. And I did that with regularity. Time for a new wife, you know? And my counselor in Kaiser had 17 years in the program. She kept trying to get me into AA. I started out with an abuse. I did that for about 30 days. I really wanted to stay sober. I don't know what clicked in me, but I was done. I was really done being done with alcohol. I had tried many times, like all of us, to stop, and it wouldn't last very long. I'd be back out there again. I quit drinking for a couple of years because of an ulcer once. That was when I was at Vandenberg and was 2 years off of alcohol. I went to Sacramento, had a doctor up there that said, man, you could have just one. Why are you not drinking? You can have just one. So, yeah, I said, I'll try that. And I went back. And my one turned into a bottle, a case, and, you know, just on and on. Now the miracle started to happen. I was at a lunch counter one day, before that, my friend, a guy that I worked with, his wife was in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know how it happened, but they invited me to the house one day in early May of 1972. And she asked me how that program was going. What's happening? Well, you know, it's great. It's like sensitivity. We talk about our problems and stuff. It was mostly their problems that I talked about, not mine. And she had an important message for me. You know, she says, you keep dicking with that hospital program and don't get your ass to Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to drink again, you SOB. Who the hell is this lady, you know? But she planted a message, and I went to my first meeting in June at a place in Encino, a speaker meeting. Same business suit from the junk tank floor, wife in hand. Sit down in a pew, looked around, and said, I don't belong here. Bunch of bums and drunks, you know? It's not my place. But I still wanted to be sober, and they gave me a directory. Some guy handed me a directory. At the door, it says, it's a newcomer meeting, try one of these. And I went to a little nut house in Van Nuys across from Valley Presbyterian Hospital. A guy named Eddie Wilson, who was the first secretary of the first AA convention in San Fernando Valley, started that meeting because they had a drunk Indian Marine guy who always got drunk on to tear everybody up and wreck the town. And he was in a padded cell. And I became really good friends with this guy when he got sober, and I learned a lot from him and learned a lot about things getting sober. And about this time, I was working in the federal building, one of the Panorama City, working in some tall building. And it was at the lunch counter one day, drinking a cup of coffee or something, sitting next to a guy. And we started talking. He told me about a lot of problems. And the guy was an attorney. He said it was an Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought, son of a gun. And I'm not going to a lot of meetings, but if I start going, I want to have a sponsor. But I don't want him to be in the same meeting that I'm in, you know. But I could say, this is my sponsor. He's an attorney, you know. And so I asked him to be my sponsor. Shortly after that, I thought, God, now that I'm sober, I want to get healthy. I want to be tough and buff. You know, I've always been part-time into healthy stuff. But I quit after a couple of sit-ups or something. You know, but now I really want to do that. And I joined the YMCA in Van Nuys. And lo and behold, I walk into this YMCA one day. And here's some jerk doing calisthenics in there. I said, the it looks like my sponsor. And I was going five nights a week, lifting weights, riding a bicycle, doing a little jogging, playing some handball. And I saw this guy every night, every night. He had so many stupid questions for me. Hey, what's going on in your life, Raymond? I started to tell him, no, I don't want the bullshit. What's really going on? He'd say, you know, what step are you working on? What part of the book are you in? You know, who are you working with? How many meetings are you going to? And this was every night, you know. And then we started going to dinner. It was even worse. But he taught me some things. He never did the books with me. He never worked the steps with me. But he forced me to carry a message. He said, Raymond, I don't know what the message is for you, but I want you to learn this program. I want you to get involved in this program, and I want you to carry the message. And trust me, the only person that needs to hear that message is you. You know. And I started doing that in so many ways. Some of the things I was involved with was I was working a 40-hour week with the federal government. I was going to UCLA on a certificate program for training and development. I was a supervisor. I thought maybe I need to know how to train and develop the people that are working for me. You know, I worked on a community hotline in Northridge as a director, as a volunteer. I went to Emotional Health Anonymous at the time. Grant High School put on a program for people with DUIs. I went there twice a week. And that was a great experience for me, because after the lecture, they spent the following hour, we broke into small groups, and I got to tell people what a great experience it was to be sober and to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And those people, you know, got to hear my message, and they got to carry the message to other people as well. I joined a program at Riverside Hospital on a rehab program. And I did things like, I taught a time management class there about once a month for the, every time they'd revolved the door, we get some new people. I taught this time management class to say, what, you know, now that you're sober, what the hell are you gonna do with all that time that you spend drinking, you know? What are the things that we can explore to maybe fill those gaps for you, you know? Because boring is just like drinking. You have a choice not to be bored, you know? And so I did those. I went to the community sessions, and I'm about 16 seconds to go here. See, I told a lot too much about yesterday, not enough about today, but I learned how to carry the message and learn how to do things like become a secretary at a meeting, to work with others, and to pass on my knowledge of the steps that I had at that time. I don't recommend it for everybody, but I was 11 years sober before I finished all of the steps. I truly believe that you only got to work them once. And it's enabled me to get a day at a time and have 50 continuous years of sobriety, and today to be completely happy with who I am and who I'm with, and to be a good partner, and to be able to love and be loved. Until we meet again, I wish you to be well, to stay safe, and God bless.